Welcome to Parents' Perspective. 4-year-old Carly was sniffing and holding tightly to her pink blanket. Her dad held her in his lap while the nurse leaned over to talk to her. In a little while, we'll put you in a pretty gown with pink bunnies on it, and you'll take a ride on a funny bed with wheels. When you get to the operating room, I will be there, and so will Dr. Scott. Carly turned around and clutched her dad. You'll be there, right, Dad? From a parent's perspective, how can we best prepare our children and ourselves for their surgery in a hospital? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today, we are fortunate to have as our guest a dad and pediatric heart surgeon. Dr. Amram Cohen is chief of cardiovascular surgery and head of pediatric cardiac surgery at the Wolfson Medical Center in Holon, Israel. A United States native, Dr. Cohen, or Ami, is also the driving spirit of the Save a Child's Heart Project. He has 2 teenage children. We're glad you could join us today, Ami.
I'm glad to be here.
Are most childhood heart problems congenital or infectious?
It depends on which part of the world you're talking about. Today, in the U.S. or in Western Europe, the vast majority of children that have heart problems will have a congenital heart problem. That wasn't true 15 or 20 years ago, and it's not true today in Africa or South America or the Middle East. The majority of the children are still afflicted by rheumatic heart disease or Chagas disease, and those infections, if not treated properly, will affect the valves of the children. And about 60 or 70% of the problems that require surgery in those countries are valve problems that are affected by those infections. The other 30% are congenital heart problems.
What happens when a child in the U.S. or a Western European country is diagnosed with a serious heart ailment?
It depends on the ailment, obviously. Out of a million population, we see about 100 children that have that kind of problem within the, or really pretty much throughout the world. When it happens today in Western countries, that child can pretty much choose, or that family can choose, where they want to be treated and what treatment. We can correct that problem in about 97% of the cases. It can usually be done in one operation. It can usually be done very, very early in childhood, as early as two weeks, almost all of them within a year.
What about the difference between that kind of situation and a third world country?
That's a real good question. If you take, let's say, a country like Israel, for example, which we'll use as a first world country, we have 6 million people. We would estimate that you would have 600 children born with heart ailments every year. In fact, we have about 350 children with heart ailments born every year. And that's because of the prenatal diagnosis that we can make, because of the prenatal health that can be taken care of. If you translate those same numbers of 100 per million and go to a country like Ethiopia, for example, we've got 50 million people. That means that you've got about 5,000 children born every year with the problem, and they have no, or did not up until a year ago, have any capability of dealing with these children at all. So if you multiply that times the age of 20, you've got 100,000 children that have this problem. So the problem is very rampant. We estimate that there's about 1 million untreated children in the world, in the third world or developing world, if you want to call it, that are not getting treatment. And when you think you can treat 97% of these people, not only treat them, but cure them, return them to a normal life, it's a pretty big tragedy that's not being taken care of.
What is the life expectancy of a child who isn't treated?
In congenital heart disease, we talk about really 3 types of problems. One is not having enough blood going to the lungs, and that's the blue baby that everybody is familiar with. And those children, if they're not treated, will develop very thick blood and will live to somewhere between 15 or 20. And it's a difficult existence. They have a hard time breathing. They have a hard time being active at all. And like I said, they'll live to about 20. The second group is a group with too much blood going to the lungs. Those are holes in the heart. And those children, eventually what happens is the lungs, from having too much flow, develop high blood pressure. It's essentially high blood pressure of the lungs. And once that becomes irreversible, those children also cannot be helped. And they live to about 25. And then there's the group that have blockages coming out of the heart, and they die at a very, very young age, like the age of 2 or 3.
So sad. What is Save a Child's Heart?
What happened is that there's a real dichotomy. As the number of children in the Western world is going down that require treatment for heart disease because of the lack of infections or the preventive medicine we can do and the prenatal treatment, our capabilities are still there, which means that there are a lot of programs that are consolidating so that they can do enough surgery. There are programs that have had to just close down. In Israel, for example, if a child is born with this kind of problem, then you have 5 or 6 surgeons that are offering the family treatment. And then you've got around Israel, in Africa, in Middle Eastern countries, in Eastern European countries, all these children that are not being treated. And like I said, we can cure 97% of them. So Save a Child's Heart was created with the idea of helping these countries help themselves in that sense, finding partners within these countries that would like to work with this and help them create centers where they can treat the children. And we do this in three ways. First of all, we go and we find a partner. And our partners are not governments. Our partners are individual groups like ourselves, non-governmental organizations. So in Ethiopia, we have the Children's Heart Fund of Ethiopia. In Nigeria, for example, we have Ibadan University, which is one of the universities in one of the cities. In Tanzania, we work with a German group that has been working there for years in primary care, and they accumulated a number of children with heart disease and had no answer for them. So we've joined forces with them to provide the help there. Once we identify this kind of partner, we work with them on three levels. Number one, we encourage them to send doctors and nurses to train at Wolfson Medical Center in this particular field. Number two, we travel to that country and we teach, we assess what they need to start advancing in these various fields. And number three, we run clinics for the children that need the surgery. And until they can be performed in their own country, we bring the children to Israel. And by bringing the children to Israel and having a very high-volume program within Israel, that allows us to do much more teaching and encourage and allow them to learn much quicker and be able to develop their own programs.
With taking children from all different kind of countries, have there been any international ramifications of this?
There are a number of things. First of all, we're now working with different groups, other hospitals, to try to make some kind of uniform thing to try to help these children. Number two, there's an international relations committee in the Society of Thoracic Surgery that's dedicated directly to this. I'm on that committee, and we really are advancing great strides in terms of putting this problem to the forefront. In terms of relations with other countries, for Israel, it has some significant effects. For example, the only relations Israel has with Tanzania is the fact that we bring children from there for heart surgery. There are no formal diplomatic relations. There are not even, as far as I know, particularly many quiet relations. The only real relationship Israel has with Tanzania is that. People always ask us, well, what about the Palestinians? I mean, you're operating on the Palestinians. Is there any political effects or whatnot? And I guess that can best be illustrated by the first Palestinian child we operated on. First, we brought children from Ethiopia, and then we brought children from Moldova. And the pressure was building. I mean, people were asking us all the time, well, I mean, these kids right next door, why aren't you operating on them? And we said, you know, we'll be happy to. We just have to have a partner. And we have a partner who is a religious Christian who lives down in the authority. And it's really quite a sight to see. He gets up every morning, and outside his home in Khan Yunis, which is a refugee camp, there's a long line of kids and mothers with problems. And he refers them to various places in Israel, not necessarily heart. He refers all the heart to us. So when this got started, we began to operate on Palestinian children. And the first little girl that came, her name was Aziza, and she came from Hebron. And we weren't quite sure how to deal with this. She came with her entire family, and we were very formal. In other words, we explained the procedure. We were very polite. She had a tetralogy of Fallot, which is a mildly complex problem. The operation, unfortunately, was very, very successful. She was in the hospital for 10 days. I explained, did all the formal things, explained to the parents what had happened and what they could expect and whatnot, and they were very formal in return. And 10 days later, she went home. And I figured, well, you know, it's the beginning. And I was driving home that night, and I was listening to Israel has one of its national radio programs. It's called Galei Tzahal, which is the army airwaves. And I was listening to that, and this particular family had been driven back to Hebron and got stopped at one of the checkpoints. And one of the reporters decided they wanted a perspective of, you know, somebody who is being stopped at the checkpoints and having his life interfered with and whatnot. And they stuck a microphone into this guy's face and said, well, what do you feel about these Israelis not letting you travel back to your home and whatnot? And the reporter got quite a shock. It was this girl's father, and he said, you know, I would have answered this totally different 10 days ago, but we just spent 10 days in Israel without any uniforms or any government things, just people that wanted to help, and they saved my daughter's life, and for no other reason other than we're neighbors and they wanted to help. And I'm sure that somehow or some way, with the way we're reacting, we're going to make peace among ourselves.
Can you give us an example of how a child's life has changed as a result of this kind of surgery?
Well, every one of these children, really, their life changes. These are children that really cannot do anything. In other words, if they come to Israel to have the surgery, they really can walk 4 or 5 steps, and that's about it. They're either short of breath or they're blue. And once the surgery is done, they really return to be normal children. And they can do essentially just about anything. I guess one real good example would actually be the first little girl that we operated on. Her name was Helena. And we took a very, very careful look at exactly how we were going to plan bringing this young girl. This was back in 1996, how we're going to bring this young girl to Israel and what we're going to do with her and whatnot. With all the planning and everything else, the child was in shock because you got to picture a little girl in a little village in Africa, and she's never seen anything. And all of a sudden, a car shows up in the village, and everybody's gotten around this car, and here the sickest kid in the village gets put in the car. Now, we couldn't afford at that point to bring her parent. So she's put in this car, and she's just about getting over the shock of that. She ends up in an airport and flies on an airplane to Israel, and then she lands in Israel, and all of a sudden, for the first time in her life, it's all white faces. So...
And everybody's speaking a totally different language.
Well, if you know how children react, you have this child whose shoulders are hunched up and she's looking down at the ground and she's not willing to interact with absolutely. We sort of figured out everything except where this child was going to be before surgery. So it turned out my parents have an apartment on the beach in Netanya, and they took her there. And we drove her there, and we put her on an elevator, which was another big experience. She didn't understand what was happening. All of a sudden, she was going up. And we get into the apartment, and she opens the door, and she looks out the window, and she starts talking a mile a minute. I mean, all of a sudden, she's excited. She's animated. There was an Ethiopian person who was working, and she came, and she said what it was is she saw the ocean. This apartment overlooks from the 14th floor the Mediterranean Sea. And Ethiopia is landlocked. They've never seen the ocean. She had never read about the ocean. She'd never seen a picture of an ocean. And she wants to go down to the ocean. But, of course, this kid can only walk 5 or 6 steps. And for sure, it's 100 steps down to the ocean and 100 steps back. Well, we brought her into the hospital. It was Friday. We brought her into the hospital on Sunday for surgery. And probably this illustrates what we do best. This child needed 40 minutes of surgery. All she simply needed was a single vessel to be tied. It was a piece of silk that cost, $5 to tie off this blood vessel. And these children are basically healthy except for this particular problem. So this child that couldn't move at all, wouldn't take more than 5 or 6 steps without being very short of breath, within 3 or 4 days, we couldn't even keep her in the hospital anymore because she was running around and moving and so on. I went to visit her the day before she went back to Ethiopia, and she went back to this apartment, and she's sitting there in this nice yellow new bathing suit. And she took me by the hand, and she walked down with me to the beach. And she played on the beach, and she built sandcastles on the beach. And she was able to run back up the steps, up the 100 steps. We see her every year. We go to Ethiopia once a year to run follow-up, and we see her every year. And she remembers 2 things about Israel. She remembers the terms Yebeseder, it will be okay, and she remembers the word Yam, which is sea. And she's now sort of the world traveler within this village, and she's a totally healthy child. She's in the 3rd grade now, and she's the hero of the village. She's been around. She tells him about the ocean, and so she's had a very profound effect on her life.
How about the community? You're talking a little bit about her community. How about the communities when these children have been pulled out?
Well, it was interesting. The first time we came to Ethiopia, we couldn't quite understand. We came there, and we were all excited because we had enough money to offer some surgery to children. And we just didn't see any light in the parents' eyes. And they explained to us later that a lot of people had come through and given talks, but nobody had ever actually gotten out to have surgery. And we had a waiting list of about 20, 25 kids when we first got there. When we gave out the first tickets, within a month, the waiting list went to 700.
Oh, my gosh.
And when these kids came back from Israel, they had over 1,000 people waiting for them at the airport just to greet.
All the
children that have this problem, they're very, very close among the various parents because it's a chronic thing. Versus, say, the United States, you have this problem, your child has surgery, and then your child's normal. These parents have to struggle with this and have no real answer for it. So they essentially have this sick child that they can't help in any way, and they become very close. They're like this giant family. And when they come to Israel, the Ethiopians in particular, they help each other. In other words, the kids that are 12 or 13 will be taking care of the kids that are 2 or 3, like their little brothers and sisters, because they constantly see each other in the clinic and whatnot. So when they came back, they were actual heroes. And today, they're very, very close. We've operated on over 100 children from Ethiopia, and they're a very close-knit group.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion about heart surgery for children and the Save a Child's Heart Foundation.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Amram Cohen about pediatric heart surgery and the Save a Child's Heart Foundation. When a child faces surgery, what is the child's biggest fear? Now, that's, I guess, different when you know, in different circumstances.
Right. It's very, very different between the developed countries, the Western countries, and the children that we're dealing with. If a child is 3 or 4, which is today becoming more unusual, most of the children we operate on today are now under 1 year old, and we don't have that much to deal with that. But the children that are 3 and 4, we put a tremendous amount of effort when an Israeli child or an American child has to come to surgery. They come to the hospital a few days before, and they play games with the staff, and they go through a trial run down to the operating room to make sure they'll know everything that's going to happen to them. The children that come from the third world countries are totally different, because to them, there's so many waiting. It's a big prestige thing almost, or a big honor to go to the hospital. And we see these children in Ethiopia, and we give out candy, and we play with them. So when they come to Israel, they're ready to go. I mean, they think they've been chosen for something very special. Now, it doesn't mean that the 4 or 5 year olds don't miss their parents. We've spent many a night. When we first were getting started, we had some of these children in our home, and my wife spent many a night with a child on her shoulder who was missing her mother, you know, or missing his mother 1 or 2 days after he got there. But overall, it's much easier with these children because they think and they've been told what a wonderful chance they have and so on, and they're very excited about getting there.
How did you deal, by the way, with the language barrier? Obviously, you were lucky in the first instance to have an Ethiopian in the apartment development, but when you had kids at your house and kids in the hospital?
Well, first of all, in Israel, it's very easy to deal with language barriers because there's people from essentially everywhere. I mean, when we bring people from Russia, there's obviously no problem. There's a large number of Russian Jews. There's a large number of Ethiopians. But when we do have to deal with problems, it's very much with sign language. I mean, kids, as you know, if you have a 3-year-old, you give them a piece of candy, you pat them on the back. But the other thing we do is we bring with each of these groups from different countries. We don't have the money to bring a mother or a parent with each group. So from each country, we have living in Israel a social worker or a nurse that's trained with this. So there'll be 6 kids from Ethiopia and the nurse. And the nurse has to speak English and her language as well. So right now, for example, we have nurses from Tanzania, Nigeria, Ethiopia, and Moldova in the hospital, and doctors coming from China, I think, as we speak.
Now, what about parents? What's a parent's role in preparing a child for something like this? Obviously, when they come from another country, that's one thing. What about parents in whether the surgery is going to be in the same country?
Okay. Different? There's really a dual role. Number one, the parent has to not make the child think that it's totally something fun or whatnot. You can't be dishonest with the child. The parent has to be relatively honest with the child in terms of you have to go through this and we're going to go through this together and these are the doctors and they're going to help you and so on. I think the children catch, especially when they come into the hospital and there's other sick children, they'll understand they're being lied to. If you try to make this totally a game or a fun thing, the parents have to be able to be honest with them in the sense of what they're going to go through. On the other hand, what the kids pick up more than anything else is the anxiety of the parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, the 4 or 5 year old is not very upset when you tell them you're going to go to the operating room, we're going to give you an airplane mask, and you're going to dream about an airplane. What they see is the mother holding back tears and the father, and the parents have to try to control that around the kids. I mean, they need to release, obviously, but they really have to find a way not to do that around the kids because the kids pick that up very, very quickly. And that's really the thing that we have the hardest time dealing with is when the kids realize that the parents are very, very anxious about the thing. Then we have a hard time with the kids.
That's true in many circumstances
right.
In raising kids. How are children from developing and third world nations selected for surgery in the Save a Child's Heart program?
Yeah, well, first of all, you have to go into how we select a partner. Mm-hmm. And we don't work with governments. We work with non-governmental organizations. And essentially, we're looking to work with people that want to work. In other words, if we have a cardiologist and a group in their country that want to help their kids, then we're willing to work with them. And what we do is we create in each one of these countries a clinic. And we go to that clinic once a year. And the responsibility of the partner is to screen the children. So we'll see between 75 and 100 children at each clinic. And their responsibility is to screen the children as best they can so that we're seeing mostly children with heart disease. And from that group, usually if you see 100 kids, unfortunately about 20 or 30 of them, it's too late. In other words, you see the children are still there, but they've had a hole in the heart, there's too much pressure in the lungs, and you can't do anything. Another 15 or 20% don't need anything. And that's sometimes a real dilemma to explain to the parents that we're not taking your child not because you didn't make it. We're not taking your child because your child is fine. And then there's a group of about 50 or 60 that need the surgery. Now, what we do is there's a few that need it right now before the pressure gets too high in the lungs or they're very blue. And we tell them that medically we want to take these children first. And then we leave it to our partners to decide the order in which the kids come, because we feel that the people that know best about what's going on in Tanzania are the Tanzanians. We go there once a year. We have the medical knowledge, but the understanding of the social structure, how which family can deal with which kid, they understand that much better than we do. So short of the real medical emergencies that we feel are going to die in the next month or two unless we see them right away, we leave that to them. The most difficult thing, obviously, is with the financial constraints. If there are 60 kids that need surgery and we know we can take 36, that becomes a very, very difficult problem, and they deal with that as well. We don't say yes, no to these children. We say we can deal with 36. These four need to come right away. These 20 we can help. These 20 don't need it, thank God. And then they choose how to send the kids, and they send them in groups of six or seven with a nurse or a social worker.
And they come in an airplane to Israel.
That's
right. And then who's responsible for them when they get there?
The partner group is responsible for them until they hit the ground. Once they hit the ground in Israel, we accept them at the airport. We have housing that we've rented around the hospital. The children come to those houses. We have three workers that do all the work in Save a Child, lay people that do all the work for Save a Child. We have the three or four partners for the social workers, and they live with the children in the house. And then as we have room in the hospital, they come into the hospital and have their surgery.
And then go back to that house?
They go back to the house. One of the things that's a little different than surgery for Western countries is our objective when we're dealing with kids from Western countries is to operate on them and get them out of the hospital right away, back to a healthy environment, and get them back to a home environment. We can't really do this here because there's small problems that come up after surgery that whereas if it happens in Washington, D.C., we'll bring them back into the clinic, we'll do something, and that'll be the end of it. If it happens in the jungle or if it happens in a small village where there's nothing that can cost the kids his life. So what we do is after we've convinced that they're finished and they're healthy, we still keep them in Israel for another 2 weeks. And just to make sure that there's nothing small that's going to pop up that would cause a real big problem being far away. And during that time, we have a whole massive group of Israelis that take these kids on trips, take them to the beach. The two big attractions in Israel are Jerusalem, obviously, because we do a lot of religious Christians and Muslim children, and the ocean, because a lot of these countries are landlocked. So we have a lot of volunteers that come and take the kids for various trips all over the country afterwards.
Ami, I have a two-pronged question for you. One is, how can our listeners learn more about Save a Child's Heart? And how is the foundation funded?
Yeah, let me answer the second question first, if I can. All the work to date is being done at Wolfson Medical Center and among our partner sites. But the foundation is actually an international foundation, and it's being supported in addition to from funds from Israel. It's got chapters in England, in Germany, in Canada and the U.S. In the U.S., it's based in Washington, D.C. There's a website, www.saveachildsheart.com. I'd like to repeat that, www.saveachildsheart.com.
I'd like to ask you to repeat on the air a wonderful story that you told before we started about a disappointment that happened as a result of your operations in a village.
One of the things that is a little unusual with our group of patients is that these patients are looking forward to be operated on. And first of all, one of the disappointments, actually, one of the things we had to explain to one of the fathers, one of the fortunate little girls that we had from Ethiopia actually didn't need surgery. We could help her with a balloon and balloon her valve. And when she went back to Ethiopia, she was disappointed, and the father was very disappointed that the child didn't have surgery. And it was a hard time explaining to him that, in fact, we didn't do surgery because we could do it in a better way without risking it. Another little girl actually was just heartbroken. She came with a group of six from Ethiopia, and the other five had been operated, and she fortunately didn't need the operation. And she was absolutely heartbroken. She was crying all the time, and she was depressed, and she had stopped eating. So to solve the problem, one Friday morning when we weren't operating, we dressed her up in her scrubs, and we put a hat on her head, and we wheeled her down to surgery, and we put a mask on her face, and we drew a little blue line on her chest, and we scrubbed it off, and we took her back to the ward so she would feel like she was down to the operating room just like all the rest of the kids. And after that, she was very happy.
Well, we are grateful to you, Dr. Cohen, because you have made a lot of happy endings for a lot of children, and you've certainly told us an awful lot about the work you do today.
Well, thank you.
Our gift for our first caller today will be an autographed copy of our new book, Parents as Mentors. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573. That's 1-800-791-8573. We look forward to hearing from you. We'd like to send you Parents as Mentors. The book is available at all major bookstores and through the web. To order tapes of any show, send a $5 check or money order to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015. That's Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
You can also reach Parents Perspective through your local station or by email to parentsper, that's parents, P-E-R, at AOL.com. Or again, call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573. To learn more about us and our book, Parents as Mentors, visit our website through our shortcut address, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.